And I'm joined in the studio by a man who's gone from heavy metal to tin, Steve Loopy Newhouse, and his debut fiction book, Justin, which was released officially yesterday. Steve, welcome to the studio. Tell us all about this amazing book.
Well, thanks for having me. Justin, where did Justin come from? I actually started writing Justin around about 15 years ago. Completed it, but it still needed a little bit of work. And the guy that you've had in here, Nick Barrett, we used to work together. And we sort of started banging ideas between each other, and I sort of carried on writing, and then just put it to one side. And then he released the book, and I thought, well, why not? So I tidied it up, sent it off to the same publishers, and they liked it, so...
Well, tell us all about what's the whole idea of the book, because it's not your average run-of-the-mill book, is it?
it's a mad, mad, crazy story. It starts off with a young boy called Barry who is very, very clumsy. And he and his dad build a robot. And his dad's involved with Secret Service, MI3, I call it. You know, it gets promoted to MI6 later. Dad gets involved with a terrorist organisation and disappears. And later on in life, they sort of tend to use the robot to try and track Dad down again. That's the basics.
And, well, this is an 8-foot-high robot, Justin, with remarkable powers. The main power is the ability to be extremely rude to people. This is humour on the adult part of the spectrum, isn't it?
He's a boy. He's very obnoxious, very rude. But it works. I mean, it could go as a kid's story too. You know, I'm sure if it was cleaned up quite a lot, but it could work.
So where did you get the ideas from? Any? I mean, because it's, as I say, it's a far away idea as an 8-foot rude robot. But where did it all come from in your head?
Oh, I think that's just. You know, they do say that everyone's got a book in them, and these ideas have been knocking about for years. When I was working as a stagehand, I used to have a lot of time on my hands. So I used to like, sleep on the floor at Hammersmith Odeon after we'd do one finish, like one show, stay there overnight, do the next one the following morning. And I used to sit there with a little kid's notepad, just jotting things down. And I think that's probably where it all started. I always had the idea of this like, kid with a robot. But finally, you know, it sort of turned into Justin.
So you'd probably say that the people who are in the book, the robot, is probably an amalgam of people that you've met over the years in your dealings in the music business, in just in general life as well.
It's based on a lot of people that I've known over many, many years, even including my dad, because my dad has such an amazing sense of humour. So I think some of the comedy side of it comes from there.
So what was the writing process for it then? Did you just, I mean, a lot of people talk about process, get up in the morning, write, but as you say, you left it for a long, long time.
So. I did, I mean, when I was actually writing it, because I was working on a night shift, and I'd go on my break, sort of three till four, and I'd just sit down and write 3 or 4 pages, go home and type it up, but then keep going. So I was getting home at just after 6 in the morning, and I sat there writing until noon, but I'd take a notebook to bed with me as well. And if I suddenly sort of woke up with an idea, I'd be sitting here writing again. You know, it just built and built and built.
So as I say, it came out officially yesterday. Was it released?
34,
yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, 31st, of course. How amazing is it to have? I know, obviously, you've been published before, but this is your first fiction book, isn't it?
It's first novel, yeah.
First novel. How is it having that out now?
When the boxes turned up a couple of weeks ago, I had 2 boxes with 20 books, and they hadn't told me they were coming or anything. The books just turned up. And so actually, it sort of opened them up. And all of a sudden, it's like, hang on, man. This has finally happened. But it, I mean, there'd been lots of stuff going back and forwards like between myself and the publishers. They sent me the first draft that they'd had somebody sort of do the proofread. And there are footnotes at the bottom of certain pages. And I was finding those footnotes 3 or 4 pages further on, so I'm having to correct them and move them all about and send it all back. And when they sent back the last proof, apart from a few little errors that need to be adjusted, they've actually sorted it out properly. And when you see it in book form, it's something else.
Now, I mentioned heavy metal in the intro. Well, you were part of Iron Maiden's backstage killer crew of roadies. Well, right from the beginning. What was your role in the team?
I was a general dog's body. I mean, basically, the very, very start, 78, when Paul Di'Anno I knew him as Paul Taylor then, but he's actually known as Paul Andrews. He took his dad's name, his stepdad's name, became Paul Taylor. Where the Di'Anno thing came from, I have absolutely no idea. But we were best mates for many, many years. And he passed the audition, he got the job we made, and basically he was getting bored of me going, well, him going on his own. So he said, you know, do you want to come along? And that's it, I sort of started going along and stayed. Very early days, I was probably the fifth member. And they had various guitarists that come and go. Then they had Paul Cairns. Paul Cairns was on the demo, on the Soundhouse tapes.
And this is one that you've sort of found out more recently, isn't it?
The funny thing was, I got chatting with Dougie Sampson, the drummer then. And I said, do you remember Paul Cairns? He said, yeah. I said, well, do you remember him actually playing on a demo? And he went, no. I couldn't either. For some reason, we totally blocked it out of our minds. But he was there. If you listen to the demo or listen to the Soundhouse tapes through headphones, you can tell there are two distinct different guitars. And it's not Dave playing the other one, certainly not.
And well, it's all part of folklore. And then in these early stages, this is, you know, it all gets down into this murky and mythology, that sort of thing. As you say, Paul Di'Anno was your friend. I think you said maybe he might have got the nickname because he'd had a pizza once. I think there was no Italian heritage there at all.
He come from anywhere. I mean, he tried to convince everybody he had Italian, lots of grandparents. And, well, that's news to me. I've known the guy for years, you know. So, yeah, I think it was the pizza.
But you were doing it early on in the early stages. It was all completely free. You were just doing it all off your own back, weren't you? Doing it just for the love of the thing.
We didn't actually start getting paid until about a year later. Maybe 6 months, but, yeah. I mean, when Rod came in, I mean, Rod was there for about 6 weeks before we found out that we were going to get paid 30 quid a week. I mean, by that time, I was out of work anyway. So any little bit coming in was help, you know.
Well, you travelled the world with Maiden. It was certainly a soap opera. How much like Spinal Tap was it?
No, nowhere near it. It was very professional. I mean, like right from the start, very, very professional. Dave Lights, I mean, he knew exactly what he wanted. He knew what he was doing. Pete did the guitars. I did the drums. You know, it was simple.
And, well, there's plenty of stories early on with the Green Goddess that you had to get around, didn't you? You were using that, and that was the mode of transport.
It was. I mean, the funny thing, when we got the original Green Goddess, it was literally, you got three people in the cab, you had a tail lift at the back with a shutter. So all the equipment went in the back, and we'd sit in the back with the equipment. And then the van went away for a couple of weeks. And when it came back, they put another shutter on the side with bunks. So you had three bunks on the right hand side, you had two bunks on the left. And then above the driver's cab was enough room for five of us to lay in a line. They put two windows at the front as well, so we could actually look out the front. And we were on the M4, and we'd missed our turning. We'd gone under this bridge, but missed our turning, and Vic decided to do a U-turn on the M4. So as we'd gone through the partition, and there was a couple of cones that were moved out of the way. Police car pulls up, and we're going, okay, like now we're in trouble. And it wasn't until the two policemen sort of started, you know, talking about, oh, you can't do a U-turn on the M4, blah, blah, blah. And also, one of them looked up and realised these five pairs of eyes are looking down on them. And he went, so notice his mate, he went, up there. And all of a sudden, he went, anyway, carry on. And I got in the car and drove off.
Now, it wasn't all fun, though, because some of it was a difficult experience for you.
A lot of travelling. It wasn't brilliantly comfortable. It was tough work.
And, well, your relationship with Clive Burr is something that's been it was something like an ongoing saga, and I know Clive's no longer with us, and you had a great relationship, but at times it was a fractious relationship, wasn't it, in terms of you were his drum tech, weren't you?
Clive was a very difficult person to work with, and the proof in the pudding was that it was somebody else that actually saw it. I think I was just so wound up by the whole situation. What was happening was that we were setting up the kit for the sound check, and I would set it up exactly how it was supposed to be. The kit had, it was colour-coded, each part was numbered. I mean, it couldn't go wrong. We even had little Jubilee clips, so like the stand, part of the stand going into the next part couldn't go any further. It just couldn't go wrong. So I'm setting it up day after day, and what was happening was he was coming in, sit behind the kit and go, I'm not happy. And he'd move that bit, and then he'd move the next cymbal. And he'd go around the kit, yeah, that's fine. He'd get off. And then he'd come back to do the show and move it back to exactly where it was. And I'm concentrating on those seals, none of it's falling over, he doesn't need a bottle of water, he doesn't need a towel. But it was one of the other crew that said, he's just moved that back to where it started. And it didn't matter what I did, I could not please the man. And eventually he got his way and I got fired in May 81.
And then, but then you were back when Nico came into the band.
Yeah, it just goes to show the band didn't want me to go.
But you put yourself in a dangerous situation with Clive Bird, didn't you? You were inches away from his foot in one recording position, weren't you?
A couple of occasions in the studio, there was a rattling. There was one particular song they did on the Killers album, and the snare, I think it was the snare that was rattling, and the only way we could stop the noise was for me to actually sort of lie on the floor beside his hi-hat and just sort of put my finger on the snare to stop it rattle when it wasn't being used. And that was uncomfortable. And then the second time was when he put his foot through the bass skin during a live show in Norwich, and all our flight cases were all down the side of the building, and I've had to run off the stage, find the flight case, get the new bass skin, and then run back onto the stage and try and fit it while he was still playing. Not the easiest job in the world.
Now, all this, of course, is documented in your book, Loopy World.
Yeah.
It's a great... I mean, I've read your columns on Metal Talk, and it's fascinating description of what it was like. Well, I mean, it was a completely different world because you were with Maiden, obviously, when they started, and they were in small rehearsal rooms and they were playing at the Ruskin Arms and pubs like that, right up until they're playing big venues and they're with Kiss in Europe and they're headlining tours in the UK. But one of the key, one of the key factors is also your fractious relationship with Rod Smallwood. The two of you really didn't get on at all, did you?
I think Rod, obviously he's done a great job. Whether anybody could have taken that role, I don't know. But it was just his... He didn't have a problem with Dave Lights. He didn't have a problem with Pete Bryant. He didn't have a problem with Vic. But for some reason, he had a problem with me. And fractious, I think, that's a good word.
And when he tried to have you do a lot of things, including dressing up as Eddie.
Yeah, I hated it. In fact, one of the tour managers, a guy called Tony Wiggins, decided that I'm not going to get caught out. So he used to wear brown cords every day so that Rod couldn't go, well, I'm not having him wearing brown cords if he's Eddie. Tony was smart.
Now, as you say, you left Maiden in 84. What did you go on and do next, straight after that?
I'd already spent a bit of time working for a local stage group called Stage Miracles, based over in Potter's Bar now. And basically, I called them up from Florida and said, right, I finished with Maiden. What's coming up? And they said, we've got a few bits and pieces, we'll let you know. And sure enough, they called me, and it was like slotting back into it because I'd already been with them for about 6 months. But they did everything. It wasn't just sort of heavy metal shows or rock shows or even music shows. We used to go out and do car sales. Or we did one case, we were at in Norwich for a week doing the Anglia Water AGM. It's just pay the bills.
The rocking world of AGMs. Yeah. And then you moved to the rocking world of the Royal Mail.
Yes, 95. I started at Royal Mail as a casual, sort of doing Christmas sorting, and stayed. And I was there for 21 years and finally retired last year.
So what made you turn to writing then? Because you left school, no qualifications in 72, did you? So, I mean, it's not what you would typically call a writing existence, is it?
I had a lot of problems at school. And the stupid part about it now is that the main problem I actually had at school was with my English teacher. So this is what goes around, I suppose. Yeah, I had a lot of trouble with a guy at school and played truant. And my mum and dad got a letter at home. And, of course, I'm truant. I've gone home lunchtime. There's this letter, and it's been opened. And it's, OK, I'm in trouble. So I ran away from home. Didn't go very far, but when I got back, I sat in the car with my dad, and he said, look, this is obviously like causing you a problem. Do you want to leave? And I went, yeah. So it turns out that the only GCSE or GCE back those days, O-level, A-level, the only thing I was actually being offered was arts and religion. What can you do with art and religion apart from paint Bibles?
painting vicar, you can do, yeah. But.
You know, so, and that was it. You know, so I left. I already had a part-time job in the supermarket, and I sort of explained it to the boss there, who offered me full-time, and that was it. You know, the first 3 years I worked in the supermarket.
But then the writing bug just hits.
That didn't actually start until, well, as I said, when I was actually working as a stagehand. But I think I got more into it while I was at Royal Mail. I got my first computer. That was the year 2000, something like that. And it's just been non-stop since. You know, therapy. That's what it is, therapy.
So you've got a good few books in you left now, a few ideas rattling around the head.
Justin 2 is finished, and that is a mad story. If you think that's mad, this is even worse. Justin goes off to a planet far, far away, and meets an Irish drunk version of Jesus, but he's called Jesus.
And we're getting a flavour of it already. Well, you see, that's the art of religious studies influence coming in.
Sort of silly little things like, you know, instead of Holy Grail, you got a Holy Pale.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Bucket you keep throwing at me. But yeah, that's finished. I've got another one called Too Ill to Die, which is loosely based on my childhood, but I've turned my mum into an outrageous drunk, and my dad's a superhero. It's an alternate superheroes. And that again, you know, it's just a mad story.
Now, we've gone all this way, and we haven't even mentioned the origin of your nickname yet. You don't seem that loopy sitting here right now. I don't know how you were back in...
A sensible moment. That came about as a guy, was a mutual friend of Steve Harrison, Paul Yano. This is the guy, Trevor Searle. He actually introduced the two of them together. And we were at the studio doing something. We were out having a pint somewhere. And I just said something, and Trevor just turned around and said, oh, don't worry about him, he's loopy. And Steve just looked and laughed, and he stuck. You know, all of a sudden I'm being called loopy. It was like, let him go on with it.
Well, the Justin's Out came out on the 31st. You got Loopy World. Where can we get these two brilliant books?
Right, Loopy World is available at the website loopyworld.co.uk. Justin is available on Amazon or through Pegasus Elliott Mackenzie.
And if we want to find out more about what you're doing, what you're up to, you're on social media as well?
Oh, yes. I'm on Facebook. I actually have another page on Facebook, Loopy World. And on there, I do a daily thing called On This Day. And I'm 2 days into doing the Kiss tour in 1980. In fact, like, we only got one more show, and then we had a week off, which is talk about perfect timing, because on Monday I'm taking a week off. So.
History repeating itself eventually.
Yeah, perfectly. Yeah.
So Justin is out now, published by Pegasus Publishers. Steve, thank you very much for joining us.
Very well.